Well, as always, it's good to see you here this evening. I'm especially happy to see our members from the west side of town who managed to make it through all of the tens of thousands of people going to the Super Bowl today. Good job, Woodalls. Especially, I want to welcome any visitors that we have with us this evening. It's our hope as we gather together again to worship at this hour that we grow closer to God through study of His Word. And that we would also grow closer with each other through communion in His Word and communion through song and prayer and at the appointed time through the Lord's Supper as well. So we do hope that we're going to grow closer to God and each other at this time. Have your Bibles open to the book of Titus. That's going to be our text for the evening. It's the book of Titus, and we're going to look at several different passages in the book of Titus. So we're not going to be doing a whole lot of talking about Titus as we study the book of Titus. I actually want to notice more about the Cretans than Titus. It's interesting that as you study Titus, even though the short epistle has Titus's name attached to the front of it, and even though he was the original recipient of the letter, there's actually more that you can tell about the Cretans in this letter than you can about the recipient. I found that to be very interesting as I was studying it recently. I came across in particular chapter 1 and verse 12, which says that one of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, "Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons." And he says in verse 13 that this testimony is true. And I'll admit something. I've been studying the Bible for a long time, for most of my life. Honestly, I never understood what Paul meant by that. As he was quoting this Cretan, one of their own, a prophet, who said that Cretans are always such bad people, and then Paul goes on and says that it's a true testimony. Whatever they say about Cretans turns out to be absolutely true. So, of course, in our Bible study, what's expected of us by God is that when we encounter these kinds of questions, we kind of wonder, like, what does that verse actually mean? What does he mean by that? I think we're expected to dig a little bit deeper and see that there's a lesson to be learned there. Otherwise, God in His wisdom, working in the Holy Spirit through the Apostle Paul, would not have included a verse like that in the book of Titus. So let's talk about the Cretans for a few minutes here. The island of Crete itself. The island of Crete itself is in the Mediterranean, and during the first century, when Paul would have been writing this letter to Titus, Crete was part of a Roman province. Interestingly enough, even though it was an island that was located very much closer to Greece, the island of Crete was included in the province that would be in like modern-day Libya. I don't know what to make of that, except that Crete was, in that time period, a relatively unimportant place. It's not exactly a place that people were clamoring to go to. The island itself is actually a pretty foreboding island, especially from the south. As you approach it from the south, all you see are these cliff faces. I mean, it's almost like the Cliffs of Dover sort of an image when you look at it. The north side of the island is a little bit more sloped. It's a little gentler. So most people actually lived on the north side of the island, which is interesting. When you're reading the book of Acts, and there at the end of the book of Acts, when Paul is on his way to Rome to face Caesar in a trial, they actually go around the southern side of Crete. And it says, according to Luke, that they had a very, very hard time finding a port on that side of the island. And I think that's interesting that as you read the book of Acts, it ends up lining up very, very well with reality. They said they had a hard time finding a port. The island of Crete was a very, very rough and rocky place on the southern shore of that island. Here's an interesting thing, and maybe Lance and I might find this interesting because we like to climb mountains. But here's this little island in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, and there are mountains on this island that reached as high as 8,000 feet in elevation. 8,000 feet rising from the Mediterranean Sea. That is an incredible height. So when you look at Crete, it is a foreboding, unwelcoming, rocky sort of place. Being what it was relatively unimportant. In fact, Crete was known in the Roman Empire not because of any economic contributions that it made to the empire as a whole. It was actually more known as a home for mercenaries and pirates and runaway criminals. People would go to Crete, which starts to shed some light on this quote of Paul's as he says that one of their own prophets says that Cretans are pretty rotten people, and the testimony ends up being true. There's a historian of Greek descent named Polybius who writes in the second century this very quote. Epimenides, excuse me, is the one who wrote this quote here. But I want to quote something that Polybius said here of this kind of idea of Cretans being these lazy gluttons and liars and evil beasts. This is what Polybius had to say in the second century BC of Crete. Money is held in such high honor among them that its acquisition is not only regarded as necessary, but as most honorable. So much, in fact, do sordid love of gain and lust for wealth prevail among them that the Cretans are the only people in the world whose eyes no gain is disgraceful. Now, it would be impossible to find, except in some rare instances, personal conduct more treacherous or a public policy more unjust than in Crete. Going back to that quote there, that Cretans are always liars and evil beasts and lazy gluttons. That was a man named Epimenides, who said that. Very hard word to say. Who was a philosopher and a thinker who was from Crete. And it's interesting, isn't it, that a Cretan would say that about fellow Cretans. Here's how interested in wealth the Cretans were. And this is why Epimenides ended up saying this about his own island. The Cretans were so interested in wealth that they had actually set up a sepulcher for Zeus, the Greek god. Now, the only problem with that, according to Epimenides, is that if you're going to believe that the Greek gods are gods, that these people are immortals, that these characters have some power, why did you just build a sepulcher for your own god? Of course, it was for tourism dollars, you know. If you can set up a sepulcher for your own god, for Zeus, you get people to come visit the sepulcher and spend money on your island. And Epimenides was so offended by the notion that you could build a sepulcher for an immortal god that was the conclusion that he came to about the Cretans, that these people are completely and utterly ridiculous. That is the backdrop for the epistle to Titus. I know we went really far out of our way in that introduction, but I think it's important that as you study Titus, you have to know these are the people that Titus was preaching to. These are the people who Paul even agrees with Epimenides and says, yeah, it's absolutely true. Good luck with that, Titus. They are evil beasts and lazy gluttons, and they're always liars. And that's the material that you have to work with. And that's what got me thinking about this lesson, is that the book of Titus is not about Titus. The book of Titus is about Crete and its people. And isn't it amazing that as you study this short and sweet and wonderful epistle, that anybody from Crete could possibly have internalized this message and made themselves into the kind of people that God expected them to be. In the midst of such a predominantly wicked civilization, here's Titus, seemingly all by himself, an island, on an island of evil, preaching the blessed gospel of Jesus Christ. Our lesson today is going to focus on the Cretans then and what was expected of them by Titus, by Paul, and by God, and how we face surprisingly similar circumstances today in our own preaching and in our own teaching. So I'm going to go through a series of conclusions that I came to in studying the book of Titus about the Cretans. This is what I learned about Crete from Titus. First of all, you learn that Crete was not an evangelistic dead zone. What I mean by an evangelistic dead zone is that sometimes we have this assumption that there are some places in the world that are easier to evangelize and other places that are much harder to evangelize. Las Vegas, for example. I mean, surely Christians can't thrive in a place like Las Vegas, right? Anybody from Las Vegas in here, by the way? Yes, that's what I thought. Surely Christians can't thrive in some of these places. You would think that if you looked at a map of the Roman Empire and you took stock of the moral value or the moral compass of various and sundry parts and provinces of the empire, you'd think that Crete would be the last place that Christians would thrive. You'd think that Crete would be the last place that the Apostle Paul would say, hey, say, we need to send someone and go preach there, you know? We need to go set up some churches there. We need to go establish a few congregations. And while we're there, we also need to appoint elders in every city in those congregations that have been established. You'd think Crete would be the last place that you would want to go evangelize. But even on an island like Crete that was so renowned for its piracy and its wickedness and its lying, even on Crete, there were Christians. Obviously, you have to make an inference here, but when he says in Titus 1, verse 5, that I left you on Crete to finish what we started, which is namely to appoint elders in every city, don't you kind of have to have a congregation in every city in order to appoint elders in every city? You can't just appoint elders without a church. You can't have a shepherd without a flock. You can't have an elder without a congregation. So the inference is that wherever they are appointing elders, there must be congregations of Christians there. Now, I don't necessarily mean you have to take it literally that every single city and every single village on the island of Crete must have had a thriving congregation. I'm simply saying that there is a very sound inference there that says wherever you're appointing elders, you have to have a church to appoint elders. So there must have been multiple congregations that existed and were thriving to the point of even being in a position to appoint elders on the island of Crete. Another thing to notice here, in Acts chapter 2, verse 11, on the day of Pentecost, as people are hearing the apostles preaching in their own languages, they're all looking around going, but we're all from different parts of the empire. We all have different dialects and different languages. What does it say in Acts 2, verse 11? That there were some there on the day of Pentecost listening to Peter preach who were from Crete. That might have been, and I'm just saying, might have been, that might have been where a lot of the beginning of these churches came from. That you had Jews in Jerusalem on Pentecost from Crete who were there for the festival. And while they were there, they heard this magnificent thing called the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that some of those Cretans were baptized on the day of Pentecost. And after that, they went home to their island and helped establish congregations. Because the reality is that when you read the book of Acts, it doesn't appear anywhere in the book of Acts that Paul or Titus spent much time on the island of Crete. They weren't the ones establishing congregations. Cretans themselves were establishing congregations. Cretans were teaching Cretans the gospel. This was no evangelistic dead zone. This was actually an evangelistic hot zone for them. Go to chapter 3 of the book of Titus. And notice another thing here. And again, an inference that we'd like to make, but I think it's a very, very sound inference here. Notice in Titus 3, in verse 8 here, it says, this is a trustworthy statement, and concerning these things, I want you to speak confidently, so that those who have believed God may be careful to engage in good deeds. He says, those who have believed in God. Just the very fact that Paul is saying that there were those who believed in God meant that on the island of Crete, there were those who believed in God. There were believers on this island. And there were believers on this island who were very, very eager to accept the message that Paul wanted Titus to preach. And there were believers on this island who were ready to change their deeds and perform the good deeds prescribed by the teaching of the gospel. And again, this was no evangelistic dead zone. Do we sometimes make the same assumptions about our own land? Think about on a map of the United States of America, and here's your lovely map of the United States of America with population density represented by these bars. Where do most people live in the United States of America? California and New England. A little bit in the upper Midwest, I understand. You got Chicago thrown in there. But most people in the United States of America live in these major cities on the East Coast and the West Coast. What's the assumption that we tend to have about churches or religious affiliation or Bible knowledge? We assume that places like California and the upper Midwest and New England do not have strong churches or strong Christians. Do we sometimes make the same assumption about Phoenix? Is Phoenix an evangelistic dead zone? Just the other day, Craig was saying in Bible class Just the other Wednesday night, Craig was saying how much grief he caught from the Southerners when he decided to move his family out west. And he mentioned how everybody told him, well, you're going to have a hard time spiritually if you move to Phoenix. There aren't strong churches out there in Phoenix. I don't know about this move of yours, Craig. It's going to be really rough for you and Donna going out there. And I remember what Craig said in class, obviously. He said things have worked out pretty well for us here. Is there an assumption, though, as we work and evangelize in Phoenix, that, well, it's just a city where people aren't interested? People just don't want the gospel in Phoenix. People don't want the gospel in Seattle. People don't want the gospel in Los Angeles, in Las Vegas. People don't want the gospel in Chicago or New York or Boston or Philadelphia. People just don't want the gospel there. Is it a question of people not wanting the gospel? Or is it a question of a self-fulfilling prophecy? We assume that people don't want the gospel in Phoenix, so we don't try to teach them the gospel. We assume that this is an evangelistic dead zone, so we don't even try. The example of Crete proves us wrong. The next thing I would notice about Crete is that strong leadership doesn't need ideal circumstances to thrive. When you read in chapter 1, Paul gives Titus a very specific list of qualifications for elders that are to be appointed in that city. Let's notice, beginning in verse 5 of Titus 1. For this reason I left you in Crete, that you might set in order what remains, and appoint elders in every city as I directed you. Namely, if any man be above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. For the overseer, according to verse 7, must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious or fond of sordid gain, but hospitable, loving what is good, sensible, just, devout, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word which is in accordance with the teaching, that he may be able both to exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict. The lazy thing to do for the Cretans would be to say, well, you know, none of us were raised in a Christian environment. You're not going to find any elder material out of this group. And yet here's Paul telling Titus, you got to take those Cretans and appoint elders. Appoint elders. Not just, you know, possibly someday if you can. It's a good goal to look for maybe in the future. Or perhaps when you get a few second generation Christians in the mix. Perhaps when once churches have been established for 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years, maybe then you'll have some good elder material to work with. No, he says, no, I left you in Crete so that you could finish what we started, so that you can complete the task that has been set for us and appoint elders in every city as I directed you. And don't compromise on the qualifications either. Just because you're a Cretan doesn't mean that you can have it to the lowest common denominator when it comes to qualifications for elders. Ideal leadership does not need to be raised in a Christian household. Ideal leadership does not need to be a second or third or fourth generation Christian, whatever that term even means. Ideal leadership doesn't need to grow up in the church. Again, that's a pet peeve of mine. Ideal leadership doesn't, good leadership does not need those ideal circumstances to thrive and be exactly what God wants it to be. And in fact, I would even posit this. Sometimes the best leaders are those who haven't been raised in the best circumstances. I imagine some of those Cretans with a few spiritual scars, a few mistakes in their past, a few skeletons that they've had to get out in the sunshine and deal with, some of those Cretans probably turned out to be pretty good elders and pretty compassionate with church members who themselves were dealing with sins in their lives. Another thing that I learned about the Cretans from the book of Titus is this. Truth is never outmatched. Here's poor little Titus, one guy, one lonely, lowly preacher of the gospel on a great big island in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, surrounded by liars and evil beasts and lazy gluttons. Did Titus ever get discouraged? Did the Cretans look at poor little old Titus and see nothing there? Truth is never outmatched. As long as you have truth on your side, you're never up against anything that's insurmountable. And again, we look at that today. New York is a big city. I think it'd be very hard to evangelize there. Not because people wouldn't want the gospel, but just because of the sheer number of people there. Is Phoenix a hard place to evangelize? Oh, we have all kinds of excuses, don't we? Oh, it's hard to evangelize in Phoenix because we're all spread out so far. You can't invite people to church. You can't invite people to a Bible study. You can't expect people to drive a half hour to come to a Bible study to learn about the truth. Maybe we should expect people. Maybe we should expect more out of people. We have all kinds of excuses why we don't evangelize. Did you ever think that you have the greatest asset at your disposal to evangelize? You've got the truth. Quite frankly, God has the market cornered when it comes to truth. And I'll read a few passages here out of the book of Titus that I think illustrates this, that you don't have to be rich, you don't have to be scholarly, you don't have to be flashy, you don't have to show up with an army to preach the truth. Look at chapter 2, and notice a couple things here out of Titus 2 and verse 1. But as for you, speak the things which are fitting for sound doctrine. I love how plain that statement is. Titus, you're all by yourself on Crete. It's one preacher versus the world. Don't you compromise, Titus. You go and you preach sound doctrine. I don't care if you're alone. I don't care who you're up against. You go and you preach sound doctrine. That's your job. That's what your mission is. Do it. Notice in chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. In all things, show yourself to be an example of good deeds, with purity and doctrine, dignified, sound in speech, which is beyond reproach, in order that the opponent may be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. You put the opponent to shame by your behavior. You might be the only person in a room who's living for God. You might be the only person in the room not laughing at that dirty joke. You might be the only person in the room who's willing to compromise your career so that you don't have to compromise God. You might be the only person in the room who's a Christian. But you put the others to shame because of your behavior. Notice another verse here at the end of chapter 2, the last verse, verse 15. These things speak and exhort and reprove with all authority. Let no one disregard you. I don't care if you're by yourself. With all authority, you speak and exhort in these things. Don't let anybody toss you out. Don't let anybody disregard you. Don't let anybody write you off. You are not going to disappear. You are not going to ride off into the sunset. You will not be marginalized. You're a Christian. You're a saint. You are God's people in this world. Act like it and be bold. That's our job. And truth is never outmatched. Truth is never outmatched. Last point that we'll make. Reputation. That's a good picture, by the way, isn't it? Crumpled up piece of paper with the word reputation on it. We like our reputations to be all smoothed out. And any of the parts that look ugly, we'll kind of cut them off so people don't see it, right? What was the reputation of the Cretans? Their own poet, their own prophet, their own eminent philosopher, the laureate of the island of Crete, said Cretans are liars and beasts and lazy gluttons. That's pretty tough to stomach. I mean, quite frankly, I don't like it when Americans say bad things about America. I don't like it when Dennis Rodman goes and hangs out with Kim Jong-il. Kim Jong-un? That's the son, right? I don't like it when people badmouth my country. With the Cretans? It was justified. It was totally, completely, reasonably justified. So that Paul tells Titus, that Epimenides guy, he was right. He was right about the Cretans. That's their reputation. Boy, sometimes we come into this whole Christian thing with a really ugly reputation. We come with baggage. We come with skeletons in our closet. We come with things from our past that we're so ashamed of that we sure wish that even God didn't remember what we did. We come to God with so much junk. Imagine how the Cretans felt when these strangers from a distant land showed up on their island and said, "You can be saved. Imagine how they must have felt when some of their own Jewish Cretans came back from the day of Pentecost and said, "You will not believe what we heard in Jerusalem last week." Imagine how the Cretans must have felt when somebody came along and said, "You don't have to be liars and evil beasts and lazy gluttons anymore." They've been told that they were garbage all along. The Romans didn't like them. The Greeks didn't like them. Everybody knew that Cretans were horrible people, an island of pirates and criminals and liars. Imagine how encouraging it must have been for somebody to come along and for the first time ever say, "You don't have to be your reputation anymore. You don't have to be what everybody thinks you are anymore." That's the difference between living by the world's standards and living for God. While it might feel like it takes a double effort to rehab that bad reputation of yours, I want to assure you of something from the book of Titus. You don't need anything more than what the gospel prescribes. You don't need anything more. You don't need anything less. What the gospel prescribes for you is enough. It is sufficient to make you into the person that God wants you to be. Whether you've come from a horrible background or a pretty squeaky clean background, we all need the same thing, don't we? We all need the same thing. Paul gives some advice in chapter 2, verses 2 through 14. He gives advice to older women, how to teach the younger women. He gives advice to younger women, how to live in a godly and discreet manner. He gives advice to younger men and older men, and now you're supposed to be examples and leaders. He gives advice to slaves, servants. He says, you serve your masters. Obey those who are in authority over you. You think that was hard for those Cretans to change their lifestyle like that? Turn to chapter 2 and notice a little bit out of this context here. I want to point something out here. Do you think it was hard for the Cretans to read a verse like this? Pick up here in verse 11 with me, in chapter 2, verse 11. "For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men." That's a new message, isn't it? But does it come with a cost? Yeah. "Instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires and to live sensibly, righteously and godly in the present age." That's hard for Cretans to do though, isn't it? You know, when you've been told all this time that Cretans are a certain way and you need to just act like the Cretan that we all know you are, it's hard to expect anything more out of yourself. We live up to our expectations, don't we? If we expect a lot from ourselves, we tend to match that. If we expect very little from ourselves, we tend to live that as well. You all know that one of my favorite TV shows, though not for the faint of heart, is on Nat Geo channel. It's Drugs, Inc. Interesting show. I'd say I love the show, but it's too disturbing of a show for me to say I love it. I'll say I'm enthralled by it. One of the things that you tend to hear a lot on the show, and it's a documentary about the lives of drug producers, drug dealers, and drug addicts, as well as the police officers who are trying to bring them to justice. But one of the things that you hear a lot on this show is, "My daddy was a drug dealer. My brother's a drug dealer. I'm a drug dealer." When you're raised in the hood, when you're raised in this environment, when you're raised by trash, you tend to live up to that expectation. And a lot of these people, whether they're the drug users or the drug providers, a lot of these people don't expect a lot. They say, "Hey, all my family members, all my best friends from high school, even my own family, my own dad, they were all shot and killed by the time they were 20. Why should I expect anything more from myself? Why should I expect anything more?" The gospel says to people like that, to Cretans of the world, you should expect more from yourself. You should expect a lot more from yourself. You should expect yourself to deny ungodliness, to not live by worldly desires and lusts. You should expect yourself to be sensible and righteous and discreet and honest and honorable. You should expect yourself to live a life that God would be proud of. Read the next verse here in verse 13. "Looking for the blessed hope and the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself a people for his own possession, zealous for good deeds. Best way to rehab a reputation is to start right now. There's no dark past, no seedy history. There's no damaged goods that cannot be eternally and finally solved by what God prescribes. Change your mindset. Change your behavior. Give yourself over to God for guidance, instruction, wisdom, and salvation. And your whole life will be altered by that. I'll tell you, my friends, if God can find people on the island of Crete who are interested in the gospel, and if Paul and Titus can preach, and baptize, and teach people on the island of Crete who want to change their lives, I'm sorry, but not even Phoenix has anything to offer. Not even Phoenix has an excuse. Not even Phoenix. Titus is about the Cretans as much as it is about Titus himself. And this sermon is as much about you and me and our neighbors as it is about Cretans. Will you apply the things that you've heard tonight? Will you read the book of Titus with fresh eyes, with new zeal, with new excitement for serving God today, not tomorrow or 10 years from now or when you feel like it? I encourage you at this time, whatever spiritual need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.